A Supreme Court ruling on carbon emissions and a ballot push for solar power here in Florida. What it means for the state, just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Show is always live on the radio at 9, but now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Never miss a program. Just ahead, lots to discuss from the Supreme Court to the Florida Supreme Court and what they're looking at. We want your calls right now when it comes to energy and how it affects consumers here in the Sunshine State. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, our own contributor, Jay Solomon, with some thoughts for your holiday weekend. Plus, how you can be part of a big new public art project in downtown Jacksonville. We'll tell you about it. All of that ahead. But first, this morning on Monday, the Supreme Court blocked Obama administration rules aimed at limiting the hazardous air pollutants like mercury that emanate from the nation's power plants. This, even though the ruling's effect on Jacksonville's utility, JEA, appears to be limited. Now, at the same time, there are updates on efforts around that solar ballot initiative here in Florida. Four utilities around the state and Florida's attorney general are working to block the initiative, saying it's potentially misleading. This, as the group Floridians for Solar Choice filed a legal brief this week supporting the effort. They argue it will remove barriers limiting ownership models of solar generation. So, this morning we begin the show with an in-depth look at the energy sector and what's happening with it this week and how it will affect us all. Here in studio, we welcome Jay Worley, Director of Environmental Programs at JEA. Hi, Jay.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. And joining us by phone, Stephen Smith. He's the Executive Director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and the founding member of Floridians for Solar Choice. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to be with you and your guests.
Great to have you both on the show. And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about the Supreme Court's ruling affecting the nation's power plants? What are your questions about this ballot initiative put forth by Floridians for Solar Choice? We'll go to the phones in a little while, but get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. Jay, let's begin with you. The High Court, by a 5-4 decision, agreed with the coal industry and Republican-led states, saying that forced cutbacks to the nation's power plants on hazardous emissions are too costly and could actually lead to power outages. What's JEA's response?
Well, the mercury air toxic standards were finalized about 3 years ago, and they were going to be implemented here in April 2015. JEA's position on that, with our technology that we have at our facilities, there would really be no impact, of course, and we were well positioned at the time. This April, when the rule went into effect, the JEA were in compliance, and we moved forward, of course, with MATS. Now, what the ruling was from the Supreme Court, they were looking at what the D.C. Circuit Court had ruled on, and that they basically remanded it back to the D.C. Circuit Court to say that the appropriate and necessary actions that were not taken because they didn't consider cost. So they remanded it back to the D.C. Circuit Court. However, the MATS rule still stays into effect, and JEA is in compliance with that at this point.
Which is good news for JEA and all of your ratepayers. Let me ask you as well, later this summer, the Clean Power Plan, which has been put forth by the Obama administration, is targeting carbon emissions from power plant. JEA has spoken out about these proposed rules, saying that the timeline for these reductions is too quick, too sharp, too unachievable. How is JEA looking to respond to the Clean Power Plan regulations that are due out later this summer?
Yeah, we expect that final to come out in August. We've been tracking that very closely. We've been analyzing it in every situation that we could think of from a scenario how that would impact the customer. Right now, just like every organization, we anticipate that, like I said, coming out in August, and we'll be evaluating that. There are some concerns, of course, not only the implementation as it was in the proposal, but how it would affect the customer from a cost perspective, and also how the generation would be. The two main things we look at is affordability and reliability then, of course, how it benefits the customer.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment, whether you want to talk about the EPA's Clean Power Plan or Floridians for Solar Choice. It's a big energy discussion on the show right now. We'll get on the line with you in a moment at 549-2937. Stephen Smith, the state Supreme Court will soon hear arguments over Floridians for Solar Choice's ballot initiative. Now, Attorney General Pam Bondi and four utilities around the state have opposed your ballot initiative, saying that the language in it is misleading if it does end up going before the voters. Can you do two things? Explain what the initiative wants to do, and what's your response to the criticism?
Okay, well, thanks again for having me on the call. Just to your first points about the air toxic rule and the Clean Power Plan. I agree with Jay that the air toxic rule is important and basically stays in place, and we're very supportive of getting those emissions out. And to JE's credit, they have advanced technology on the coal plant that they have, so I would concur with that. I think the Clean Power Plan is critical to a state like Florida, which has such tremendous vulnerabilities to climate impacts. And so while there are always concerns about how a new rule will impact cost, there also are tremendous benefits, and EPA did a very good job of looking at those benefits in proposing the draft rule, and I anticipate they'll stand in the final. And so we are eagerly awaiting that rule later this summer, and I think it's long overdue for us to be addressing climate change because, again, Florida, with its tourist economy and its vulnerability to extreme weather, it's absolutely time that we have some leadership at the federal level and the state level. And the federal government is going to allow the states to develop their implementation plans on a state-by-state basis. So I think it's important for people not to be deceived about that this is going to cause wildly escalating costs and everything. I think it's a matter of developing a smart implementation plan that helps us solve the problem as well as advance new technologies that are not contributing to the problem. And I think that's the opportunity that we have when this plan comes out. So we'll see what the final rule looks like. On Floridians for Solar Choice, we're excited about that. There is a rule on the books in Florida that basically prevents customers from buying solar-generated electricity from anybody else except for, in essence, a monopoly utility. And that rule is long overdue to be repealed. There's only four states in the United States right now that explicitly prohibit the sale of solar electricity to a customer, and Florida is one of those states. And Florida is a sunshine state. There's absolutely no reason why we should be prohibiting the freedom of choice to allow customers to have that option. And what it really means for customers is that it means the ability to have someone come in and provide, in essence, a financing option to allow them to buy down those upfront costs that allow more customers to be able to put solar on their homes. Because whereas the utilities build billion-dollar plants to serve many, many customers, they spread those costs over a long period of time, and they're recovered in the rates. When a customer puts solar on their home, they're providing electricity for themselves and potentially for the grid, but they're incurring all those costs themselves. And so having an option to work with a third-party provider to help do that financing is a critical piece of growing the solar market in Florida and letting more people across the income spectrum be able to participate in having solar on their homes. The criticism, as you said, is coming from primarily the utilities, and they're calling in their favors from the Attorney General. A lot of, particularly the investor-owned utilities, have given significant money to her and her party in order to get her elected. And it doesn't surprise us that she is she's taking this position as a favor back. Her argument and the arguments from the utilities is that somehow or another the ballot initiative is misleading, that they have this fallacious claim that somehow or another rates are going to be cross-subsidizing between customer classes, which has never been fully documented, and there's no evidence of that in Florida. And the amount of penetration rates that we're seeing with solar deployment in Florida, these are non-issues, but they're being elevated to scare and confuse consumers to try to get people to oppose this. We're not that worried about it. Anytime you run a ballot initiative, it's tricky to get through the Florida Supreme Court because there's such rigid requirements about what's called single subject And you have to be very, very precise in your language. So that's always a little tricky. But we're looking forward to the court. Yesterday, the rebuttal briefs were filed, and the oral arguments are going to happen on September 1st.
And it's your chance to connect with both JEA and Floridians for Solar Choice. What are your questions when it comes to energy in Florida? We'll go to the phones in just a moment and your emails and tweets. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Jay Worley with JEA. What about Stephen Smith's argument that Florida's one of only four states left now in the country where citizens and businesses can't buy and sell solar power directly amongst themselves? What's JEA's position on that?
Jay has been tracking legislative actions, and also we work closely, of course, with our customer base. JEA is historically promoted solar. In our portfolio, per se, we already have 12 megawatts of solar, and we're going to be adding another 38 megawatts by the end of next December. We also have a pretty robust net metering program, which you're looking at right now, how we talk about rates and equity there, how that works across as far as our customer base. And also we have, of course, our electric car charging stations that are being promoted at this point in time, and hopefully we'll have those engaged out in the community in the near term. But JEA, we want to make sure that the customer base is educated. It's really tumultuous times, uncertain times, when you look at it from a regulatory standpoint. But really, it's kind of an exciting time when you think about kind of development of energy policy as we see it today. And solar is a component of that, all the other renewables, as well as traditional and energy that we're seeing brought forth today.
Right. And as renewables become more accessible, Stephen Smith, just to push back on you, some of the arguments against heavily investing in solar deal with the baseline load in the power grid. Utilities like JEA saying that they've got to make sure power is reliable and affordable for their ratepayers. What about those arguments that have been put forth against the increased availability of solar, which isn't always reliable, or at least that's the anti-argument?
Well, it's look, I think any time you are advancing and working with the grid, you need to be careful and thoughtful. JEA is correct. I mean, I agree with the gentleman that they have been a leader historically on solar power. They've done some really good things over the years. And he is absolutely correct. We're in a very dynamic time. It's an exciting time because these technologies, the price points are coming down, where solar is in the money now in a lot of ways. And there are a number of smart grid technologies, smart inverter technologies. The gentleman mentioned electric vehicles and battery storage and all these things. This makes it a very dynamic time in the industry, and we should embrace that. We should embrace that innovation. We should embrace those opportunities, and we should be looking to how to bring more clean energy onto the grid so that we reduce our overall emissions of pollutants, particularly carbon dioxide. So this is an exciting time, and we have to do it in a smart way. But there is nothing about solar power that is at all definitive that it is somehow or another causes instability in the grid, that causes the lights to go out. It's all about grid integration, being smart about it. The technology is there. It's well proven in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. There's nothing unique about the Florida grid that says that we can't do a significant additional integration of solar in. We need to do it smart. We need to work with our utility partners in making that happen, and I think everybody should be pulling in the same direction. What we resist is that, and this is really less with the public power entities like JEA, because they are, they're sort of owned by the city and owned by their customers. It's the investor-owned utilities who have a responsibility to try to maximize profits for their shareholders, like Florida Power and Light and Duke and others. They see this as an intrinsic threat to their shareholders' profits. And so because when a customer is generating their own electricity, they're not buying power from the utility. And so what they're trying to do is come up with all these, we think, overblown and scare tactics to try to scare customers away from having solar choice in a way to control their profit margin. FP&L made $1.5 billion, billion with a B, off their captive rate base in Florida last year. They see that as a golden opportunity that they do not want to lose, and they see solar as a threat. They're willing to build plants that they own, but they don't want customers and businesses to generate their own power because they lose revenue. And that is the bottom line. You can cut through all the arguments for the opposition and get straight to the bottom line, which is particularly investor-owned utilities do not want to lose market share to distributed solar.
All right.
And that's why they're
opposing it. Thanks, Stephen. As Stephen pointed out, Jay, JEA is different from some of the other investor-owned utilities around the state. It's heavily regulated and city-owned. The profit motive isn't as big a motivator. So you as a utility, you come at this, I would say, from a slightly different place than some of the other utility players around the state and the region, correct?
Absolutely. And Steve's correct. We are, of course, a public utility. We do have different requirements as far as associated versus the investor-owned utilities. However, we do not have your traditional shareholders. Our shareholders are the customers of Jacksonville and the surrounding areas and our customer base. Our job, one, is to the community and to the customer. We want to make sure, once again, we have reliable energy and also affordable energy. Another duty of JEA is we're obligated to provide energy to the customer. It's a requirement. We want to make sure, and it goes back, you know, critically to the fact that we want to make sure that the customer base is educated. Like Stephen was talking about, grid stability. When you start increasing solar, we want to make sure that there is that reliable energy and there is not instability within the grid, because solar at certain times, of course, is sporadic. I always say that half the day is night. There is certain times when you don't have that consistent energy that's being produced put on the grid. So we want to make sure that's a point that's very much reviewed, and integration is one of the things that we're looking at right now.
And we're rebooting our phone system. Lots of you waiting on hold to talk. Let us give us just a moment on that, and let's go to some of your tweets right now as we speak with JEA and Floridians for Solar Choice. Here's a tweet from ESI Sustainability. What are the barriers to community solar in Jacksonville, and how can we as individuals and businesses overcome them? A question for both of you. Let's go to Stephen, then Jay. Stephen Smith.
Well, there are four types of, we sort of view there's four types of solar. There's utility-owned solar at a large scale. There's community-owned solar, which is utilities tend to put it up, but they actually open it up for customers who may not be able to put it on their roofs or their homes. And then there's commercial scale solar and there's residential solar. I think community solar is an area that we're going to have a lot of agreement, and we are working with utilities across the Southeast and in Florida to encourage those type of programs. And if they're well done and well planned and the benefits flow all the way through to the customers who participate in the community solar projects, we're very supportive of them. We are leery, though. There are some projects that are being represented as community projects that are really just PR ploys by the utilities to try to sort of make it look like they're doing more in solar. So how those programs are designed are critical, but we think they're something we can all agree on.
Jay Worley.
Absolutely. And of course, JEA, being a leader from the utility solar side, we of course have that 15 megawatt DC, and we're going to be adding about 38 megawatts AC. But to kind of build what Steve was talking about on the community solar, we're looking at that very seriously. Of course, there's individuals out there on the customer base that don't have that opportunity or the income to put solar, or just as far as logistically, to put solar on their residence. And so we want to have something out there that it possibly is available to them, and that's where community solar comes in, so they can be part of that.
And someone just tweeted us a link to a study from Yale. Households and businesses with solar panels deliver greater benefits to utility companies than they receive through programs like net metering. That's according to an analysis of 11 case studies from across the U.S. Net metering already exists here in Jacksonville.
That's correct.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course, the basis of net metering is when an individual puts a solar system at their location, they consume that portion of the energy that's being generated. However, if they have an overabundance of generation, that energy can be sent back to the utility. So we have a meter. It's called a net meter. It has two registers on it. One registers the amount of energy that's coming from the household back to JEA, and the other goes is to the energy. If they need that energy, it goes back. So once again, we are obligated to serve. And one of the most important things is that we're looking at a rate structure right now, because believe it or not, the subscription rate to net metering has increased incredibly, like over 100 in a year. So we want to make sure there's rate equity there. And you're talking about when that energy is coming back from the consumer, you're using the wires and the poles and whatnot. And we want to make sure that that's accounted for in a reasonable way.
And our phone system is back up and running. We welcome your calls at 549-2937. Stephen Smith, great explanation on net metering from Jay Worley of JEA. What Floridians for Solar Choice is advocating is actually taking solar one step further, allowing homeowners and businesses to buy and sell solar power outside the purview of a major utility.
Well, a couple of things. Net metering is a critical provision, and what the Yale study and other studies have shown is that if you really do the analysis, there are benefits that come from having solar systems out in a distribution network, out, you know, in communities, because the power is generated where the load is, the power is consumed there, so they don't have to necessarily use the poles as much, and there's less line losses. There's what are called ancillary services, which are a number of things that help the grid on the distribution network. And so when the analysis is done carefully and in an unbiased way, the value of solar is actually greater than what a lot of the utilities want to tend to give to it. And what we're worried about with net metering is that in some states, utilities are coming back and doing, quote-unquote, rate analysis and all these other things, and what they're doing is actually coming up with a justification to add additional charges to the net meter customers as a way to really disincentivize or slow it down. There's all types of cross-subsidizations that goes on in rate making, and I don't want to get into a lot of the detail of that, but what we want to make sure doesn't happen is that there's not discriminatory charges against customers who are generating their own power in the name of quote-unquote customer fairness, which is really the utilities trying to manipulate the numbers to discourage solar. That's where we need a lot of transparency. We've actually reached out to the Municipal Association in Florida to have some dialogue about this, to make sure that if we're going to do that kind of analysis, that it's done in a real transparent way so everybody knows that it's fair. Now, the ballot initiative, as you said, goes a little bit further, because what it's doing is it's allowing customers to be able to buy not only from the utility, but to buy from a third-party provider and enter into a contract. If that provider wants to put solar on their home, they can directly buy the electrons from them as a way to finance the system. Because, again, solar costs have come down tremendously, but there still is an upfront cost associated with putting the panels on your home. And just like cars or houses or, you know, remodeling your kitchen, very few people actually write a big check. What they usually do is finance, lease their car, or come up with some sort of an option to be able to spread those upfront costs. In Florida, those options are very limited, and what the ballot initiative would do would open up the option for customers to have greater choice to be able to participate in the solar market.
Jay.
And so net metering is a big part of that.
All right, Jay.
And Steve, he had a point there. When you really, when you start looking at these scenarios, and the same with the initiative that's ongoing right now, you really have to look at the business model, and all these have business models, and that's really when it comes really important to educate and have that transparency there so you can look at it. So as I said, we're very promoting solar, and we want to just make sure that we're part of that conversation.
And our phones are up and running. Let's go now to your calls at 549-2937. Mitchell in Palatka. Hi, Mitchell. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I've been involved in this for quite some time, and I have solar panels that I bought myself, and I am now completely disconnected from the grid, mainly because my local supplier refused to trade fuel for me. I have so much dead wood around here, I could have easily supplied all the fuel that I needed at the power plant. I didn't need to buy coal, but because of that, they would not trade with me for my deadwood. They disconnected my connection because I would not pay for coal, and now I have nothing but solar power, and I don't need the grid anymore at all, and never will. That's my comment.
All right, Mitchell, thanks. Stephen Smith, a small but growing number of Floridians are in Mitchell's shoes, correct?
Yeah, and this is going to be a trend that potentially grows, because many people remember not just a few weeks ago that Elon Musk talked about battery storage and the ability for people, because as Jay said, we all know the sun comes up in the morning and it sets in the evening, and people still use power in the evening, and so there needs to be the ability to, you know, have access to electricity. If the utilities are not careful and they set up punitive rates against solar power, or as this gentleman talks about, don't really treat customers fairly, a lot of customers are just going to basically cut the cord. And we've seen that with landlines, with telephones. So what we need to do is we need to be smart about this, because what does cause real problems, potentially, if the utilities don't plan for it, if you have a lot of grid defection where people leave altogether, then you have a lot of stranded investment. So we think that the right balance is for the utilities to encourage solar, treat their customers fairly, deal with this issue in a responsible, clear, and transparent way so they don't drive people off the grid.
Jay.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, you know, we are, and I said it before, you know, we're on a journey. The different types of energy that's being produced in the different types of ways and from the renewable standpoint, there's other things that are coming down the pike that we need to address that. And we need to have an energy policy that does address that, and we want to do it the right way. And as I said, you know, we want to be part of that conversation. All the stakeholders need to be part of that conversation to protect the consumer.
Lots of tweets about energy issues in Florida. Josh tweets the show, why is it that the same people who think we'll find tech fixes to climate change in the future are afraid of tech fixes we can do now? Another tweet, net metering in Jacksonville doesn't pay retail. Why not? What would it take to pay the retail rate? There's a question for the utility.
Once again, just to kind of touch on the fact, and we call it really rate equity. When you start talking about net metering, and I touched on it before, you know, when you have a consumer that's utilizing solar and above and beyond their consumption and goes back to the utility, there is the need also to have that type of generation that we provide go back to that consumer when they need it. So there are assets out there, and I call them the wires and the pipes. Now, they're not using the fuel, you know, as we're burning it, you know, at that point in time, because they're using their solar system. However, being obliged to serve, we have to maintain our system, and also we have to have those systems available to when they return that energy. So there is a cost there for the utility to maintain that.
And it's 549-2937. Let's go now to Peter on the south side. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I am constantly amazed by the insularity that we have in the United States. In Germany, I believe that they are generating something like 50 to 60% of their electricity from solar. And Germany is not exactly the sunshine capital of Europe. In Japan, they are piloting fuel cells. So, you know, what I'm seeing is a failure of the capitalist model to look 30, 40 years out instead of just looking 2 or 3 years out. That's my comment.
That's Peter on the south side. Stephen Smith?
You know, absolutely. Germany is a leader, and we're learning a lot of lessons from what they're doing. And you're correct. They have the solar availability of, like, Maine versus what we have in Florida. So there's tremendous more possibility. You know, the bottom line is this, that the utilities have done an excellent job of building a very large, stable, and reliable grid, and we are all dependent on it. But they're not really good at innovating and new ideas, and they're very resistant to change. Part of that is because of the obligation to serve, as Jay talks about, and part of it is because no one wants to see their lights go out. So there's a certain legitimacy in that conservancy. But what we're seeing is that there is a fear to embrace new technologies and really do the things that allow the integration of this this technology in particular and other technologies. But it's coming, and it's coming faster than most people realize. And what we need to do is embrace that and do it in a smart way and work together. And that's what we're hoping happens. Unfortunately, when utilities put up false arguments about things not being reliable or people being cross-subsidized or people being overcharged at the levels of penetration that we have in Florida right now, which is well below 1%, that really burns their credibility and it makes it harder to have the conversation. Let's have the real conversation we need to have about energy policy, but let's do it in an accurate and real way, and let's embrace the ingenuity and the change that's coming, because that's what has made this country great, and that's why solar choice is so important. And we think the utilities should be in the business of working with their customers instead of working against their customers on them.
Jay.
I embrace this conversation. When you start talking about...
And I applaud both of you for having it with us on the air this morning.
when you start talking about Germany, they were heavily subsidized, and when you start talking about cost, JEA right now, when you start looking at, cents per kilowatt hour, you're talking about 11.5 cents per kilowatt hour. When you look at Germany today, you're talking about 3 or 4 times that on a cost for kilowatt hour. So, there's some inequities there, of course. The other thing, moving forward, and you're talking about looking how you're going to be moving into the future, there's so many uncertainties from the regulatory side. When you just saw it from having this match rule being remanded back, we saw it before in other rules. So, moving forward, you really don't have that certainty how you do long-term planning to integrate not only what you have in the mix as far as traditional fuels, but also renewables. So when you start looking at it in today's world, the uncertainties, and I've said it before, it's almost kind of exciting because you have to look at all these different scenarios and try to make the best scenario cases that you can. So when these rules come into effect, when you know it, right now, mm-hmm. of course, the state of Florida didn't have a renewable portfolio standard. We're looking at this amendment. There's so many things out there that you have to consider.
A lot is up in the air.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're talking about dollars that you don't want to spend that may not be beneficial to the customer. And so we have to look at that very strongly.
Let's take one more call. It's Nancy in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, good morning. I've been enjoying this show a lot, a very respectful conversation. And I have a question for Stephen. While you're still on the air, if you could let people know how to get a hold of this petition if they wish to sign it to promote the solar agenda.
All right. Yeah, we'll close with that. Stephen Smith.
Yeah, so absolutely. FL Florida or Floridians for Solar Choice, flsolarchoice.org. You can go online. You can actually download the petition. There's the local solar providers. I think A1A Solar in the Jacksonville area actually has petitions that they're distributing in the area. There's lots of ways to do it. You can follow us on Facebook. We're active in social media. Lots of different ways to follow this. And, again, it is a very exciting time. And as the gentleman said, there are some big decisions ahead. But the problem is you've got to embrace the arc of where we're going. And we're going to cleaner power. We're going to more distributed generation, and if the utility holds on to old central station plants all the time at the expense of embracing the new technology, you're going to see your rates go up because the regulations are coming. And so it's really about whether we're going to embrace the change that's coming and bring us into the 21st century, the way we produce and consume energy, or whether we're going to stay locked in the old way of thinking, and that's ultimately going to cost people more. And I think JEA is going to be a very interesting test case of this, because they have made some decisions that now are, the sort of birds are coming to roost. And the question is, can they pivot and embrace clean technology at a higher degree?
Jay Worley, your final thoughts.
I just want to say, too, that I agree. I mean, the times, they are changing. We do embrace that. From a societal standpoint, it's going more carbon reductions. JEA right now has a fleet of about 60% natural gas. We're moving in that direction. We're looking at every aspect, looking at this clean power plan. We know that these rules that will be coming out, that JEA, of course, will comply. However, it goes back to the fact that we need to kind of get in a granular sense and look at this so we can educate the customer and do it the most reasonable way, knowledgeable way and put it at a point where the customer understands what their selection is and how they can obtain that. And I just want to say from the listeners, they can go to jea.com and get that information or call our number that's on that website. Mm-hmm. And you know, talk to our people over there because they're very well knowledgeable on that.
And we appreciate both of you appearing this morning. It's an issue that affects us all, and it is a fascinating topic. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts.
Sure. We were joined by Jay Worley, Director of Environmental Programs with JEA, and Stephen Smith with Floridians for Solar Choice. And much more still ahead. Later, it's your chance to have your say in a huge new public art project for the city. But up next, our own Jay Solomon with some thoughts for the 4th of July. We're back in a moment.
I'm Corva Coleman. This Independence Day, join me and hundreds of thousands of guests on the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol when the stars come out to celebrate America's biggest birthday party. We'll hear the legendary Barry Manilow, KC and the Sunshine Band, country music group Alabama, the National Symphony Orchestra, and more. We're going to have a great time. Don't miss A Capitol 4th from NPR Music.
Saturday night at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, despite the 4th of July being at hand, our occasional commentator Jay Solomon is thinking more about black and white than red, white, and blue. He explains in this edition of With All Due Respect.
The 4th of July brings to mind celebrations of the birth of our nation 239 years ago. Flags, fireworks, parades, and remembrances of the bravery and genius of those who made it possible. But those 1776 celebrations were premature. The true meaning of American freedom came 15 years later with ratification of the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to our new Constitution. They placed specific limits on government power, not present in the original document. They protected, for example, rights to keep and bear arms, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, and speedy trial guarantees. Foremost was the First Amendment, establishing the freedoms of religion, speech, and press. And this is where our palette changes from red, white, and blue to black and white. The press, the newspaper. Today we call it the media, though now much more diverse in its delivery, sources, ownership, coverage, and points of view. It is the constant reflection and equalizing building block of our democracy. Thomas Jefferson, perhaps the founder most associated with press freedom, said, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." Of course, that was before he ran for president in 1800, when it was said a Jefferson victory would lead to children being taught to chant mockeries against God. The press of his day, often controlled by political parties, made no pretense of even-handedness. Like presidents now, he didn't like it, but opted for tolerance. He said, "I deplore the putrid state into which the newspapers have passed," but added, "It is, however, an evil for which there is no remedy. Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." Which brings us to NBC's anchor in ashes, Brian Williams, poster child of an imperfect but vital process. He is not the source of media turpitude, he is a symptom. As an heir to Jefferson's trust that media will help our country find its way, he fails. To be clear, though, he committed no crime. If he was a guy in a bar embellishing a hunting story, we'd take it at face value. Instead, he's a guy 9 million people watched every evening to help them understand their world, like Mr. Jefferson expected. Williams maintains he did not fib on the evening news. Rather, he apparently deliberately deceived national audiences on shows like David Letterman. Does that make a difference? Absolutely not. Just because he's being chatty and charming doesn't mean he can ignore his ethical imperative to be truthful. He is, was, the face of NBC News. He held the torch handed down by the likes of Tom Brokaw, David Brinkley, and Chet Huntley. His behavior betrayed his profession and his audience. He said, while on assignment in Iraq in 2003, a helicopter he was in was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. On further review, that chopper was hit 30 minutes before Williams arrived. That's not the kind of thing about which one makes a mistake. It now appears Williams made a number of such transgressions. He won't say how many, doesn't say he lied, but he's sorry if he misled and places the blame on his ego. His ego made him do it, as if he was not responsible. Years ago, comedian Flip Wilson did an outrageous character named Geraldine. Her get-out-of-jail line was, "The devil made me do it." The audience saw through her act but laughed at her audacity. No one's laughing at Brian Williams' act. "My ego made me do it." Would you accept that excuse from an employee? I think I could have bought into NBC's offering Williams a second chance at MSNBC if not for his evasive non-apology and blaming his ego. Geraldine had another famous line. "What you see is what you get." Sorry, Mr. Jefferson, but I think the Republic will survive. Anyway, happy Independence Day. With all due respect, I'm Jay Solomon.
Jay Solomon is a retired broadcast executive and a volunteer here at WJCT. Well, finally this hour, it's a creative approach to generating the public's ideas about public art in the city. Now, this is a project taking place at the downtown Duval County Courthouse. The Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville says it's set to be one of the most memorable permanent public art commissions in city history. Here to tell us all about it, Executive Director Tony Allegretti. Always great to see you.
Hey, good morning.
And also here, Dave Engdahl from Art in Public Places. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa.
Tony, let's start with you. What is this art project that's going on now at the courthouse?
Every capital improvement project that the city does, by ordinance, there's a mandate for 0.75 of 1% dedicated to public art, anything that's over $100,000, and clearly our courthouse is. And so, So this is over time, we have worked on making sure we fought for this art for the courthouse, and now it's come due, and now we're doing the work of getting the community ready and excited and gathering input for it.
And so that brings us to the Art in Public Places piece. The whole idea is to have more art in more public spaces, Dave, and involve the public in having a say in what is shown. Is that right?
Yes. We're very focused on this project in particular to get public input. This ought to be a community artwork. It's owned by the community, and they should provide the input. And we've set up stakeholders group to go out and solicit the community input. Tony can talk a little bit about the electronic input system that we've set up.
Sure. Okay. So we added a little bit because, like Dave says, it's a huge project. We need all corners of the county to chime in because it's everyone's artwork in our permanent collection. We added a little lanyap so that the people could get involved, and that's an email that's courthousepublicart@culturalcouncil.org. You can use the hashtag courthousepublicart. There's a website to see the comments and the input, and that's culturalcouncil.org/courthousepublicart. But what we really wanted to do is make it as inclusive and as transparent as possible because it is such a huge and important public art piece for us.
What are some of the suggestions you're getting so far?
Well, we've got some really interesting ones because people can send us photos, examples of other art. You'll see lots of ideas. There's, I think, water features. They're different, you know, all, and we're going to get, you know, there's 900,000 people in this county. So we're hoping to get a lot of varied opinions. And so...
And, of course, the Duval County Courthouse is a huge building, was controversial at the time it was built, mainly due to the expense. Once this project is complete, will there be art both inside and outside the building?
Melissa, that's yet to be determined really by the art selection panel. There are limited areas within the courthouse that where art can be installed. There's areas outside the courthouse, and at this point, we really haven't made any decisions. We haven't made any decisions whether it's one work of art or maybe multiple works of art.
People are sending you ideas like photos of the Bean in Millennium Park in Chicago, some big iconic piece like that. Tony, is that something that might be envisioned?
Why not? I mean, I think it would be a huge success to have something as iconic as the Bean. I noticed one of I think it's the Denver Convention Center where there's a big bear going in. When we first started working on this project and making sure the funds were there, we were working with now retired Chief Judge Moran, and he loves the big bear looking in on the thing. I don't know if we'll head that way, but it's so inspiring. Public art is our life every day and our quality of life, and so having something that represents the community and does give us a shot in the arm is expected.
It's a small investment with a big return. Dave Engdahl, that's been documented over and over again when you look at economic studies, and so this is a way that the public can be creative and help in the vibrancy of downtown.
I think so. This is a very large art project, particularly for the city of Jacksonville. So we're going to look really internationally for artists with really great credentials. We'll start with the credential review of artist submissions, and our art selection panel will probably get a couple hundred of those at least, and we'll have to sort through those. Then we'll select a small group and... of artists and pay them a small stipend to actually produce a design, and any art selection panel with the help of the stakeholders group will make the recommendation to the Art and Public Places Committee.
Very nice. So artists listening to this right now and people listening that might want to contribute ideas, they need to get in touch with you now.
That's right. Yeah, and that art selection panel will have reviewed and seen this guidance that will come from the community. So that's where it really kicks in.
So if you're just tuning in to this really exciting courthouse public art project, go to culturalcouncil.org/courthousepublicart and share your ideas for this Art in Public Places project. Very exciting. Anything else people need to know?
I would say this. We are a very art-focused town. This is going to be a great next several years for Jacksonville. We did a study this year, found out that our community the art and creative community is a $2.4 billion economic impact in 2013, and we're growing. So that's 27,000 jobs. This is a creative community. Let's hear it, Jax.
Yeah. Go to the website, give your ideas, get involved. Dave Engdahl, Tony Allegretti, thanks so much for sharing it with our listeners. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They're now up on iTunes. And next on Diane Rehm, the Supreme Court rules that independent commissions can draw state voting lines. What that decision might mean for efforts to curtail gerrymandering around the country, that's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our media roundtable for this shortened work week. Tune in then and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.